fear grips us. I don't know whether you've ever experienced fear as you've experienced something in your life that's rendered life out of control. It could be a wave of adversity. It could be something, it could be tragedy in your life. It could be suffering. It could be the uncertainty of what's going to happen in the future. And sometimes when you look around you, you feel as if no one actually cares. You can be in a crowd and feel quite lonely. Things seem out of control in your life. You could be feeling abandoned or overwhelmed in a situation in life. And people around you seem too busy to notice or to even know. And I don't know whether you've ever felt that way. Because when you come to this portion of the Bible, in Mark chapter 4, you have this scene taking place where the disciples of Jesus find themselves overwhelmed in a situation beyond their control. Literally, as you heard Jonah read, they were sinking under the waves. And it looks as if Jesus doesn't care. It looks as if Jesus has no concern for his disciples and their fears. He looks quite indifferent. He's asleep. And so you find them sinking in a boat in the middle of a storm. Now, we've read in chapter 4, verse 1, so far, this is where we are in Mark's gospel, that Jesus is teaching by the lake. And so I put it up there for us. Again, Jesus began to teach by the lake, and it's setting up the scene for us. Jesus is teaching by the Sea of Galilee. And the crowds gathering are so large that he gets into a boat and he begins to teach. We saw that last week. We looked at the parable of the four soils. They are standing on the shore, the soil. Jesus is sowing his seeds. And it's a picture of how people are responding to Jesus. Some people, they hear and they reject him. Others, they hear, they receive him with joy. They look enthusiastic, but you discover that there aren't any deep roots. And so because there aren't any deep roots, what actually happens is when the world presses in on them, when trouble and adversity, when temptation comes, you discover that the seeds that fall on rocky ground and the seeds that fall among the thorns, you discover everything around them crushes Jesus out of their lives. And then only in one soil, where the seed of his word goes, is it received. Is it warmly received, it's embraced, it's surrendered to, it's received immediately, deeply, exclusively. So that's what's happened so far. And you discover now Jesus has finished his teaching. It's at the end of the day. And then you read verse 35. If you have your Bibles, that day when evening came, he said to his disciples, let's go over to the other side. And so it's the end of the scene. Jesus leaves the crowd. Teaching is finished. And he takes his disciples into the boat. And they begin to cross the Sea of Galilee. And there are other boats with them. Now the Sea of Galilee, if you've never realized this, is a fairly large sea. It's a fairly large lake. It's about 166 square kilometers in size. That's about 13 kilometers across and then 21 kilometers long. It's about the size of Circular Quay all the way to Lidcombe. That's how big the Sea of Galilee was. It's fairly large. Geography is important. You might not think so, but it is. And this is where you begin to discover that the things you learn in high school are pretty important. Geography is important because what you're meant to actually realize, as Jesus sails across the Sea of Galilee, you discover that the Sea of Galilee is actually 700 meters below sea level. But north of the Sea of Galilee, and I know you can't see that on the map, is actually Mount Hermon. And Mount Hermon in the north is 9,200 feet high. And so it's a recipe for disaster because, you know, if you know anything about landscape and geography, this is what you discover. Where you have a high mountain that's snow-capped and where you have a lake that's below sea level, what actually happens? It's a clash of air, isn't it? So as cold air rushes down the mountain into the Sea of Galilee, as warm air rises up, as they two meet, something explosive actually takes place. It's like pouring cold water into hot oil. I'm sure you've never done that. But if you pour cold water into hot oil, what happens? The whole thing explodes. Well, this is what's happening here. Warm air coming up from the Galilean Sea, cold air rushing down. It's a recipe for gale force, wind, and thunderstorm. And that's what begins to happen here. And you've got to keep in mind that the disciples of Jesus in the boat with him, they're experienced fishermen. They've lived all their lives on the Sea of Galilee. So, you know, they're used to this sort of weather. They're used to the weather conditions. They're used to gale force wind. They're used to thunderstorms. And so it's really amusing in this scene. It's a comical scene because this must have been the mother of all storms because the fishermen are actually afraid. And Jesus, the carpenter, is in the boat and he's actually asleep. It's a comical scene. You see what happens? A furious squall came over and the waves broke over the boat so that it was nearly swamped. Jesus was in the stern, right? He's at the bottom of the boat. He's sleeping on a cushion, right, at the bottom. The disciples woke him and said to him, "Teacher, don't you care if we drown?" What's a squall? Well, it's a gale force winds. It's a thunderstorm that comes that's so large. It's a massive one. And you can sort of imagine that. The sky turns dark. The rain starts to fall. The winds pick up. It gets heavier. Lightning starts to fill the sky. You can't see what's in front of you because it's a huge thunderstorm. And the last place you want to be is in the middle of an ocean because this is what's happening. It's so large. The waves start to swamp over the boat. And they can't get the water out fast enough. And so they think, we're about to drown. The boat is actually sinking in a storm. And there's so much irony in the passage because the experienced fishermen are afraid. And Jesus, the carpenter, the land dweller, he's asleep in the boat in the middle of the storm. And it appears that Jesus doesn't care. It looks like he's indifferent to their plight because he's asleep. And so in desperation in this scene, you discover they wake him up. Here we are desperately trying to save ourselves. The storm is raging. It's getting worse. The boat's about to sink. And you're sleeping. And so you notice what they say to Jesus. "Teacher, don't you care? Don't you care if we drown? You're asleep. What's wrong with you? Don't you care if we drown?" And it's a great picture of desperation, isn't it? They're drowning and Jesus is sleeping. He seems not to care. He seems quite indifferent. And I suspect if you think of your own life and your own experience of the Christian life, I think we're no different. Because it's often when we're at breaking point that we begin to question God. Have you ever questioned God? When your life seems out of control, when nothing is going right, you begin to question God, right? You wonder, does he really care? Is he really there? Does he actually love me? Have you ever asked that question? When life seems out of control, right? When you're facing your own storm in life and you're sort of wondering, does God really love me? Because I suspect if you have not asked that question, at some point you will. Because this is what's happening here. You feel your life is going under. You're crushed by your situation in life. You're trying your hardest to be faithful as a disciple of Jesus, and everything in your life is going wrong because some storm is sinking you. This is what the disciples are going through. Jesus seems unconcerned because it looks like he doesn't seem to care. Now, you got to notice what happens next, because verse 39, Jesus got up, he rebuked the wind, and he said to the waves, "Quiet, be still." That's all he said. He stood up, and he said, "Quiet, be still." Then the wind died down, and it was completely calm. Now, you'll notice something. Jesus' response is effortless. Do you notice that? There is no struggle, there is no preparation, there's no pause. He doesn't psych himself up. He doesn't take a deep breath. Right? You know, some of you have watched Superman recently, and everyone tells me it hasn't been a good movie, so we didn't go see it in the end. But, you know, when you watch Superman, you notice whenever Superman is about to fly, it takes effort. He bends over. And as he bends over, you notice the ground begins to shake. You know why it begins to shake? Because he's preparing. He's trying to draw all his energy up, and then next thing you know, he goes up, he flies. Right? It takes energy and effort. Some of the guys here, I was thinking of this afternoon. I was thinking of Danny Lamb, right? Have you ever seen Danny Lamb bench press? Some of you have done that, right? You've seen Danny bench press. Some people, when they go to gym, they're really noisy. And I was trying to work out what sort of guy is Danny? Is he a noisy guy when he bench presses? Is he noisy? Because some guys are like that, right? They're about to bench, and everyone in the gym knows when they're about to bench. Maybe Danny's like that because he likes drawing attention to himself. And he goes, "Hoo!" And you can hear him. And you go, "All right, he's about to bench." It takes effort. It takes energy. I don't know whether Danny's like that. I was trying to work out which guy here was actually like that. Is Terrence like that? Right? I heard Matt goes to the gym more recently. Is Matt like that? Aaron goes to the gym with Adrian. Is Adrian like that? Do they do that? But when they lift, it takes energy. Well, you notice when Jesus does what he does is effortless. He speaks. "Quiet. Be still." The wind obeyed, the waves became still. Notice no energy expanded. And if you look very closely at verse 39, I want you to notice two things actually happening. The wind died down, it was completely calm. The wind settled and the waves were completely calm. And they were calm like a sea of glass. Now, if Jesus had said, "Be quiet," and the winds died down, you would have said, "Man, that's coincidence." Because every so often you can go out in the middle of a storm, you can say, "Quiet." And the chances are, maybe if you're lucky, the winds will die down.
But here you notice Jesus says, be quiet, the winds died down, and then the waves became still. It's not coincidence, because you and I know when a storm comes, when a hurricane passes over, even when the hurricane is over, the waves continue to pound and pound and pound and pound the coast for days, for weeks. When Hurricane Sandy in 2012, right, when it actually hit the west coast of America, even after the hurricane had passed the west coast of America, it took weeks for the waves to actually die down. They kept pounding and pounding the west coast. Jesus does two things. He rebuked the wind and the waves. He rebuked the wind. He said, be quiet, and it died down. And he says to the waves, be still, and it was still as a sea of glass. You ever tried that in the middle of a storm? I know sometimes you go to retreat, it rains, you're by the beach, in the middle of a thunderstorm, walking out into the middle of the beach and actually saying to the wind and the waves, quiet, be still. You ever tried that? No, because you're smart, because if you did that, you'd be struck by lightning. But here you see effortless power on display. Absolute control over the wind and the waves. Absolute power over the raging sea. See, it's very important for us to see what's happening here. It's not just a picture. Often people read this and they go, oh, you know, a nice Sunday school scene teaching us that Jesus is control over nature. Well, something else is actually happening, because in Jewish culture, the sea, right, in the world of the Jew, in Jewish culture, in the world of the ancient Near East, the Old Testament, the sea was a place of chaos. The sea was the great place of darkness and destruction and death. It was uncontrollable. It was untamable. It was a place of great darkness. The sea was a place of judgment. It's where the enemies of God are thrown. It's a place of the great unknown. It's a treacherous place. And you and I know the power of the ocean. How many Asians do you know who actually surf? Well, none, because the ocean is a bad place. It's a dangerous place. We don't like water. Right, you ever been out snorkeling? You notice that, you know, when we snorkel, we only snorkel in shallow waters, because the further out you get, what do you think of? You think of sharks, right? Right, Danny's nodding. Yeah, you're right, because when you are out snorkeling, the deeper the water gets, the more out of control you are. That's why people don't like the ocean. It's actually a dangerous place. It's the great unknown. It's a picture of darkness. And so the Jews believe the sea was a place of evil, and that only one person could control the sea. The Jews believed that only God could control the sea, the place of chaos, the place of destruction. Now, when you go to the Old Testament, these are some verses you discover. You notice so similar? It's so similar to what we read here in Mark's Gospel. The Lord stills the roaring of the seas, the roaring of their waves, and the turmoil of the nations. Or you read Psalm 107, verse 29. The Lord stilled the storm to a whisper. The waves of the sea were hushed. Now, can you see what's happening here? Because if you're in the boat with Jesus, you begin to realize that Jesus is doing something that only God can do. That's what you're meant to see. He speaks and acts as God of the wind and the waves. God exercising his control and his power over the wind and the waves. Quiet, be still, and it was so. Before the Pharisees on the Sabbath, which we saw a couple of weeks ago, before the Pharisees on Sabbath, Jesus demonstrates that he is king. He's Lord over Sabbath rest. He says, I can give you the rest that you long for. Rest from your performance-based lifestyle. Rest from your attempts at good work to win God's favor. I can give you rest, he says. Before the chaos and destruction and darkness of the sea, Jesus says, I can actually bring peace. I can bring control to the storm, the wind, and the waves. I have absolute control over chaos, destruction, even death. It's there. It's under my command. That's what you're beginning to see here. And then you discover there is now a challenge and rebuke by Jesus. Notice what he says to them. Why are you so afraid? Why are you so afraid? Now, when I read that, I thought to myself, it's a strange question, isn't it? That Jesus would actually rebuke them and say to them, why are you so afraid? It's a strange question, because it's not unreasonable to be afraid. It's not, if you think about it. Two, 3 years ago, the family and I, we were on holidays, and we were off the coast of Vanuatu, right? Traveling from one island to another island. And this is what happens, right? We were on a boat, and it wasn't a very big boat. It was like an 8-man aluminium boat. And midway through, going from one island to another island, the engine cut out. Because the guy was so cheap, he didn't fill up on petrol. And so the boat is in the middle of the open ocean. And the boat had died. We're just bobbing in the middle of the open ocean. And there he is. He's got this little tank at the back, and he's like, you know, trying to lean the tank over so he can get the last drips of petrol out, and he's pulling the engine. Was there reason to be afraid? Absolutely, because we're in the middle of the open ocean, and the boat has just died. It's not even storming. The sun was shining. And the kids are looking at me, and Pauline are looking at me, and I'm trying my hardest. I'm smiling because I'm trying to be brave. But was there reason to be afraid? Yes, because we're in the middle of the open ocean. Was it reasonable for them to be afraid? I think it was. But Jesus says to them, why are you so afraid? And I would have said, Jesus, yeah, I'm afraid of drowning. I'm afraid of dying out in the ocean. I'm afraid the boat will sink. I'm afraid the storm will get worse. I'm afraid we won't get out of this situation. What do you mean, why are you so afraid? Jesus, there are plenty of good reasons to be afraid. And so Jesus rebukes them. Why are you so afraid? Do you still have no faith? You know what Jesus is saying at that point? Have you no faith in me? Do you still not trust me? And do you know why Jesus says that? Because the disciples of Jesus have walked with him for the last four chapters. They've seen his power. They've seen his authority. They've seen his claims. Who is Jesus? Who does he say he is? Well, we've seen that. He's actually said he's the king of God's kingdom. He is the Messiah. And he's come to exercise the rule in the kingdom of God. And he's been demonstrating his power over demons, over sickness, over death. He claims to be the king who forgives sin. The claims of Jesus up to this point are so outrageous because he claims to be and do only what can do. He claims to be God's king, to exercise God's rule. He claims to forgive sin. You know, there's no other religious leader who has ever made such a claim. Buddha has not done that. Muhammad has not done that. And so Jesus comes to us and he doesn't claim to be a religious leader like other religious leader, like one of many choices that you pick. He claims to be above them all. And then you see him in the first four chapters of Mark's gospel doing only what God is able to do. He's healing the sick. He's exercising control over the spiritual. And then he claims to forgive sin. Do you know anyone who claims to be able to forgive sin? Which means he's either the world's biggest liar who's conned millions of people the last 2,000 years, which means that you're a disciple of Jesus, you're following a liar. It means he's either a liar or it means he's a deluded, crazy person. That means he's got millions of followers who are following a crazy person. Or he is who he claims to be, and he claims to be the king of God's kingdom who comes to forgive our sins, who has authority and power over all. Right? And so the disciples of Jesus, they just haven't heard his claims. They've seen his power and authority. He speaks and the demons obey. He speaks and people are healed. And now he speaks and the wind and the waves obey him. And so the disciples of Jesus, they should have realized up to this point, they should have realized they needn't be afraid. They should have realized they didn't have to be fearful, even as the boat was sinking. They should have realized they didn't have to be afraid even as the darkness descended on them. They needn't be afraid. And if you think with me for a moment, you wouldn't be afraid if you knew there was someone with you who had absolute power and control over the wind and waves. Isn't that right? Right? In any situation in life, you wouldn't be afraid if you knew that the person who was with you was in absolute control and they had power. You know, that's why one of the things I said to Josh when he went to primary school, the first thing I said to him is, you're an Asian kid, which means you're going to be smaller than the other kids. So what I want you to do is make friends with the biggest kids in the playground. Because if you did that and you hung with them and they were your best friends, no one would ever pick on you. And it's true. You know, when I was in high school in year 7, I wasn't a very big kid, still not very big. One of the guys I made friends with was a guy called Yura. He was the biggest, meanest guy in the class, but he was my best friend. And you know what? Walk confidently as a year 7. No one picks on you. Why? Because this guy's standing next to me. He's like 4 times my size, and he's got a bad temper. But he likes me because I'm his friend. Say what you want, do what you want. No one will touch you. Why? Because I've got a guy with me who's in control. Don't mess with him. Right? You want to mess with me? Well, mess with him. Right? And so it's true in all of life. If you know that the person who is with you is in absolute control, has power and control over the wind and the waves, there is no fear. It's true in all of life. You know, some of you here have rock climbed before, but I would venture to say none of you have ever free climbed. If you watch Netflix, you know, there's this great documentary on people who free climb Yosemite National Park. Great documentary to watch. Free climbing is where you climb the rock without any ropes, without any support. That's why it's called free climbing. Very few people do it. Why do very few people do it? Because if you free climb and you make a mistake, you die. That's the reason why not many people free climb. But you see, when you rock climb, the reason why you want someone to belay you, why you have ropes and why it's attached, why you've got someone at the bottom holding on to you, the reason why you do that is because you've got a safety. And when you climb with a safety, you know there's someone who is in control, someone who's going to look after you. Well, hopefully they will, if they're your friend. Someone who's got absolute power and control over the climb. Your heart might be racing, right? You might be a bit nervous making the climb, but you know someone's holding the rope. Someone's at the bottom anchoring you. You know that you know that when you're tired and you lessen your grip, you're not going to fall. Your hands might still bleed because it's still hard. You know, it's still going to hurt as you make the climb, but fear is gone. Why? Because there's someone holding you in control. The disciples should have known that. They should have known who was with them in the boat, in the chaos, in the storm, and in the darkness. Do you know you find the same principle in the Old Testament? Because in the Old Testament, you discover this principle. It's a reminder to us, right, that God doesn't always deliver his people. In the Old Testament, God doesn't always take his people out of that darkness, that difficult situation, that chaos, that destruction. Sometimes he doesn't lift the darkness in our lives as well, but he reminds us that he's always with us, and he's walking with us even as we walk in the valley of the shadow of death. And so you discover in the Old Testament some verses, and this is one of them, Psalm 46, verse 1 to 3. God is our refuge and strength. He is an ever-present help in trouble. Therefore, we will not fear, though the earth give way, though the mountains fall into the sea. You notice the chaos? Though its waters roar and foam and mountains quake with their surging. Who is our refuge? Who is our strength? Who is our ever-present help? Well, God is. And so knowing who is with you makes a huge difference. Now, notice what happens next, because they, the disciples, were terrified. And they ask each other, who is this? Even the wind and the waves obey him. And so it's a reversal, isn't it? From being afraid of the wind and the waves, they're now afraid of Jesus. It's crazy, isn't it? From being afraid of the chaos and the destruction in front of them, they're now afraid of Jesus. Okay? Who is this in the boat with them? They're hearing him teach, they see him at work, and they have to work out for themselves, who is this Jesus? Because something has just dawned on them. It's not an ordinary man in the boat, because he's done something that only God can do. And it's a challenge to us. Who is he? Who is Jesus to you at this point? Now, if you've never realized this, the story of Jesus and his disciples out in the open waters, sinking in a boat while Jesus is asleep, there's actually another story in the Bible that sounds very similar. It parallels another story in the Bible where we meet another group of men in a sinking boat, in the middle of another storm, where we read of another sleeping individual at the bottom of the boat. Do you know where we find that? We find that in Jonah chapter 1. Because Jonah chapter 1 reads just like Mark chapter 4. Both Jesus and Jonah are in the boat, out in the sea. Both Jesus and Jonah are asleep at the bottom of the boat. Both boats are about to sink in a raging, uncontrollable ocean. The sailors and the fishermen, right, they both woke Jonah, they both woke Jesus in desperation. Both are going, we're going to drown, right? Don't you care? We're going to sink. And in both stories, the sailors and the fishermen are actually more afraid, they're actually more afraid after the storm than before the storm. In Jonah, what you actually discover, they were afraid of the storm, but after the storm passes, you read, and I'll read this for us, after the calming of the storm in Jonah chapter 1, we read, they feared the Lord. They feared God. But you know, in Mark chapter 4, the disciples were afraid before the storm. After the calming of the storm, we read that they feared Jesus. They're in awe of him. They're afraid of him. Now, the stories of the calming of the storm are identical. There's only one difference. There's one significant difference. In the story of Jonah, Jonah says this to the sailors. This is the only difference between the two stories, right? Notice the sea was getting rougher and rougher, so they asked Jonah, what should we do to make the sea calm? Right? We need the sea to calm down for us. What should we do? And Jonah says, pick me up and throw me into the open ocean. He replied, and if you do that, it'll become calm. I know that it is my fault that the great storm has come upon you. And so the story of Jonah is the story of God's justice. The storm of God's justice has come upon this boat, has come upon Jonah and the fishermen in the form of a storm that's about to sink the boat, because Jonah is the cause. And it's his fault that the storm of God's judgment has come in the form of an actual storm. And he's right. Jonah's right. He deserved death. He deserved to die. And he says so. He says, if you throw me into the eye of the storm, if you throw me out there where the judgment of God has come, the storm will die down. The sea will become calm. I deserve to die. If I die, you will live. So throw me into the ocean of God's judgment. Why? Because Jonah is the rebellious prophet, isn't he? And they did that. Then they took Jonah, they threw him overboard into the ocean, and notice the raging sea grew calm. Now you read Mark's account of Jesus on the open ocean. No one gets thrown into the ocean. Isn't that true? No one dies. No one gets thrown into the open ocean. The man asleep at the bottom of the boat doesn't die. Jesus doesn't die until chapter 15. Jesus doesn't die until you get to chapter 15 in Mark's story of Jesus. Did you realize that? The man at the bottom of the boat doesn't die in this scene, but he does in chapter 15 when you get to the end of Mark's gospel. And I want to say to you, the reason why Jesus is able to calm every storm, the reason why he's in control of every chaos, every destruction, the reason why he's able to still every hurricane is because at the cross where he actually died, he was thrown into the ultimate storm. And the ultimate storm is the storm of God's judgment. Because there he died under the crushing waves of our judgment, our sin, and our death. You see, Jonah deserved to die. He did, for his rebellion. Jesus didn't deserve to die. He was innocent. And he was thrown in chapter 15 into the ocean of God's judgment for you and for me in our place. I don't know whether you realize this, but there is only one storm in life that you and I should actually be afraid of. Did you know that? Whatever is going through in your life, whatever you think is out of control, whatever darkness has come to your life, I know it might be a terrible place to be in, but there is only one storm in life that we should really be afraid of, because there's only one storm in life that can actually sink you eternally. There's only one storm we should be afraid of, and that is the storm of God's judgment for the life we have lived ignoring Him. And I don't know whether you realize that. The storm of God's wrath for our sin. The storm of God's punishment for the way we lift up the kingdom of self, even though we live in God's world. The way we reject God's rule. And Jesus was thrown into that storm. He was crushed under the waves of that judgment at the cross. And it is his death that calmed the ultimate storm, where he willingly faced the floodwaters and the darkness of God's judgment. Tim Keller, who is an author that some of you have read, in his book on Mark's Gospel, he writes, if the sight of Jesus bowing his head as he faced the ultimate storm is burned into the very core of our being, you and I will never say, God, don't you care? You hear that? If that scene, right, the sight of Jesus bowing his head as he faces the ultimate storm for us, if that is burned into the very core of our being, we will never say, God, don't you care? Because if you know that Jesus was abandoned to that ultimate storm, then you should realize that in the now, today, whatever you're going through, he will never abandon you. He will never forsake you because he has faced off the ultimate storm. And you know, if you're a disciple of Jesus, the good news is that a day will come when the King will return, when all the storms and darkness and chaos of life will be stilled forever, where the rule of life's chaos and tragedy and destruction will end forever. If you read Revelation chapter 4, verse 6, right, this is what you discover, that in that final scene in Revelation chapter 4, you have Jesus on the throne, and before Jesus, we read there is a sea of glass. I don't know whether you ever realized that. And the reason why there's a sea of glass, it's a reminder to us that on that day, the chaos and destruction and death of the sea of life as you know it is gone. It's still forever. And that's the reason why Revelation 21, verse 1 to 4, you also discover there, when Jesus comes for his, right, for his bride, the church, you and I, you actually discover, we read there, that on that day, there will no longer be any sea. Why? It's a reminder to us that the chaos and destruction and insecurities of your life and my life, as we know it, is going to be removed forever. That's the reason why you get to Revelation 21 and there you read, there's no longer any tears or death or mourning or crying or pain. Why? Because the storm and the chaos in your life and my life will be stilled forever. And the reason why we can be assured of that is because he has dealt with the ultimate storm for us. See, knowing that Jesus has faced the ultimate storm of sin and death and my judgment should give me confidence in the present, in the now, to face all that comes my way. It should give me strength even when life is chaotic, when things are out of my control, when I wonder if God really cares. Well, look at the one who faced off the ultimate storm for you. And it's a reminder to us that there is no chaos or destruction or darkness or death that Jesus is even now not in control over. He remains for you and he remains with you. And we can be assured that there will be a day. There will be a day when the king comes, when the wind and the waves will be still forever. Let me say three things in conclusion as a reminder to us. Here's number one. If Jesus has not abandoned you in the face of life's ultimate storm, if he's done the greater, be assured he will not abandon you right now, whatever you're going through. The fact that he allowed himself to be thrown into the storm of God's judgment for you means that he actually loves you. You wonder whether God loves you. Well, he does. He allowed himself to be thrown into the ultimate storm of God's judgment for you. And that means whatever is happening in your life, whatever the darkness, whatever the chaos, I want you to remember, and remember this, he cares for you deeply. He cares for you personally, because when you look at the cross, you see that he was swept away for you. When you look at the cross, you see the waves of God's judgment fall on him when it should have been you. You know he loves you. You know, we sing that song, oh, how he loves me. And he does. He loves you. That's number one. Number two, if Jesus was able to calm the ultimate storm of God's judgment, your sin and death at the cross, be confident that even right now, he remains powerfully in control over the smaller storms in your life. Yes, they're painful. Yes, they're dark. You feel like you're drowning. He doesn't always remove it. But he is with you through it. Keep trusting him. That's what we're reminded to do. You know, life is filled with hazards. Life is filled with moments where your life is not in control, where you feel like you're in the middle of a hurricane, where a storm has come into your life. Sometimes you think, man, heaven is silent. I don't know what God is doing. It appears God is absent. You feel like you're being swept away. And you might even feel that God doesn't care. And they're all normal experiences to be afraid. It's a normal experience. Even some of the greatest missionaries we read about in church history, right? They were afraid. They sometimes felt God wasn't there. Adoniram Judson was America's first foreign missionary. We read his biographies and we go, wow, look at all the things he was able to do. But he too experienced deep despair and depression. His baby girl died, and a few months after that, his wife passed away. And his grief in his biography was made worse by the fact that he wasn't there during her illness. And he was so swamped, he was so overwhelmed by grief, because tragedy after tragedy struck him. First the death of his baby girl, then the death of his wife. And here is a guy who is serving God, is trying to be faithful, and he's drowning in grief. And he writes in his journals, God is to me the great unknown. God has disappeared. He doesn't seem to be there. And then he writes, I believe in him, but I can't find him. But what we're meant to see is not that Jesus, you see, will calm every storm in our life. It will come. He may not. The point in Mark's gospel is this. is to reveal who Jesus is. Not that he will rescue us when we cry out. Not that the circumstances will change. It's not teaching us that there's going to be a miraculous calming of the storm every time we cry out to Jesus. Storms are part of life. No one escapes that. What we're meant to see is that Jesus is in control in my life, in my darkness, in my insecurities, in my pain, in my grief, in my suffering. He has power over the storm. And the reason why he has power is because he has faced the ultimate storm of God's judgment, which means he's in control right now. And he's for me and he's with me. There's no storm in life he has no power or control of. We're being taught here that Jesus has overcome the ultimate storm and therefore he is now in control over my life. I want to say this to you, you know, Christianity, if you're a disciple of Jesus, Christianity, you know, doesn't say Jesus will remove problems and trials and difficulty in your life. It does say, though, that Jesus has weathered the ultimate storm in your life so that even in your little storms in your life, he wants you to know that you're safe. You're safe. He remains committed to you. He's with you and continues to be for you. You know, you read Psalm 23. I love Psalm 23. Because Psalm 23 reminds us that God does not always take us out of the valley of the shadow of death. You know, you read Psalm 23, it says, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I know who is with me. I know you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. Has it ever occurred to you that when you walk in darkness, when you walk the valley of the shadow of death, what can give you confidence is knowing who walks with you. The one who is in control. And you've never realized this, you know, when you read Psalm 23, it's called the valley of the shadow of death. Have you ever been hurt by a shadow? No, a shadow cannot hurt you. It's the valley of the shadow of death because Jesus rules over death. He's faced off the ultimate storm. And it stands to reason that if he died and rose again and is in control over death, that means he's in control overall. And you know, that's the reason why we sing that song, right? Sometimes we sing that song, in Christ alone my hope is found. Well, that's what it means. He is my light, my strength, my song. He is my cornerstone. He is my solid ground, firm through the fiercest drought and storm. Do you hear that? What heights of love, he does love me. What depths of peace, when fears are still, when striving cease, he's my comforter, my all in all. Here in the love of Christ I stand. No guilt in life and no fear in death. This is the power of Christ in me. And then that final line, from life's first breath to final breath, Jesus commands my destiny. Isn't that assurance? I think it's an incredible assurance. Jesus commands my destiny. You know, Christianity, if you've not realized this, it's not a religion of works. God is not asking you to try harder this evening. Jesus never called his disciples to work harder to save themselves. He didn't tell them to save themselves, to earn his approval before he would save them. All he says is, trust me, surrender to me. He called them to trust his work for them, to surrender to his rule, his authority, and his power. That's what we're called to do. Keep trusting him. It's not a blind faith. It's a faith and trust grounded in the cross where Jesus has weathered the ultimate storm for you, which is why he's trustworthy, whatever's happening in your life. Number three, if Jesus has calmed the ultimate storm of God's judgment, your sin and death at the cross, I want you to be hopeful that there will be a day when he'll still all storms forever. A day will come. When he will still all storms forever, when whatever you're experiencing will be a distant memory. I want you to be assured that he loves you in life's storm. Be confident that he's powerfully in control of whatever's happening in your life. Be hopeful that the storms in your life will end forever one day. I know we have never sung this song at evening service, but there is a song that we introduce in morning service, and it ends with this line that has stuck with me. It says, remember the wind and the waves. The wind and the waves know his name. Has that ever occurred to you? The wind and the waves in your life today, they know his name. But here's the thing, remember as well that he knows yours. the wind and the waves, they know his name. But remember as well that he knows your name. Let me pray for us. Father, this evening we want to come to you and we just want to lift ourselves and commit ourselves to you. We want to come to you in our fears, in our insecurities. We want to come to you in our absolute weakness, whatever's happening in our lives. And we want to surrender them to you, and we want to pray and we ask that you help us to find our confidence, our assurance in you. Help us see, especially when we're struggling to walk in faithfulness, help us see when we're struggling to trust you. Help us see your love for us. Help us see that at the cross, you gave yourself up and you threw yourself into the ultimate storm of God's judgment for us. Burn that deep in our hearts so that we will never ask, we will never doubt your love for us, your care for us, your commitment to us. And help us remember who you are and that you continue to be for us even in the present, that you are with us, that you continue to walk with us. And we do pray and we ask that you help us anchor our confidence in you. Help us remember that we are loved, that because you have calmed the ultimate storm of God's judgment, even now you are with us, and that there will come a day when you will still all the storms of life. Help us anchor in that truth as we look to Jesus, as we surrender to him. We thank you that the wind and the waves in our lives know his name and that he knows ours. Amen. Let me invite you to be upstanding as we sing a couple of songs to respond.